Welcome to the next episode of the podcast on negotiation. And today we have a very special guest. It's Professor Dan Druckmann. Dan, great to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
And today we're going to talk about Dan's recent book on negotiation, identity, and justice. Hey, there we go. We even have matching books. This book summarizes Dan's great research in this area, and we're going to pick on certain topics from the book and talk about Dan's work and career and key events that have emerged as he was choosing his areas of focus. But without further ado, Dan, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. So you know my name, Dan Druckmann. I'm a person who lives on two continents for about half a year, U.S. in D.C., where I am now, Washington, D.C., and Australia, usually in Brisbane, Australia. And I like summer, so I go to both places during their opposite summers. I'm an emeritus professor at George Mason's Schar School of Policy and Government in Arlington, Virginia. And I'm also an honorary professor at Macquarie University in Sydney, and for a long time have been an honorary professor at the University of Queensland in Brisbane. The book, you know, it's Negotiation, Identity, and Justice, Pathways to Agreements, and I think we've already shown this, but I will also show you, I intentionally wore this t-shirt today, and I will stand up and show it to you. So this is a caricature of the cover of the book.
Ah.
And I found it in Brisbane one day, and a few months later, we had a panel at the International Association for Conflict Management in Greece. This was last year. We had six panelists. I bought them each a shirt, and we all talked about the book wearing this shirt. Now, to be proper, I do have a real shirt behind me if I need it, but I think, we'll just stick with it.
This one is perfect. This one is perfect.
Okay. So let me give you more background, Remy, before we get into more substantive questions. So this was what I considered to be my COVID project, by which I mean I lived in an apartment in Brisbane with my wife for 2 years during the COVID process in, what was it, 20 and 21. Something like that. We had many lockdowns. Brisbane was very good at locking people down, and good for them. I needed a large project that would occupy my time. Not a fan of memoirs, I resisted the idea for quite a while. I did, however, warm up to it when I framed the project, not as a memoir, not as an autobiography, but as something called a prosopography. And I'm sure hardly anybody has heard the word. I had to look it up, and I said, yeah, that's kind of what I want to do. So that means we place a career in a social context where contributions are made possible by a larger community of scholars. I considered my work to have been nourished by and feeding into the life of this community, very much of a kind of positivist sort of philosophy of building on previous work and then taking the next step. So with this concept in hand, I was ready to move ahead. I developed an outline, ran it by the most relevant publisher for this kind of book. It turned out to be Routledge. The reviews were good enough. They spurred the publisher and me to take on the project. It was to be part of their Security and Conflict Management series, edited by Finn Hampson and others. Then I needed to develop a structure and fill in the content, and along we went. So that's the background.
I had to look up prosopography as well. It's mentioned at the beginning of your book, so I had to innerly smile when you mentioned it again in our chat. And did you know, as I was researching your background, did you know that you have a Wikipedia website in German, but not in English?
No idea.
So that's another fun. That's another fun fact. Yes, English one is missing, but for some reason there is a German one out there. Yes, I will share a link to it after.
Okay, I can get somebody to translate probably.
is, Dan, let's talk a little bit about the stages of a rich career and how let's say those stages evolved or resulted in the research that you focused
on. Sure. So this particular career, and I guess this is why it's worth writing a book about, is an unusual one, especially for an academically trained social scientist, which I was. Perhaps this is what, maybe that's what makes the book particularly interesting. Shunning academic opportunities out of graduate school at Northwestern, I found the perfect research institute in Chicago. This was 1966, 67. It was the heyday, believe it or not, hard to believe, for basic research funding, even at applied institutes such as the one I was employed at. I stayed there for 9 years, didn't expect to stay there for more than 2 years. In the process, I was able to do what young people try to do, which was to puff up my resume with lots of research articles. But after 9 years, politics reared its ugly head, as it obviously continues to do today. And the motif of the institute changed from research to application. I needed to move on and did so with an opportunity that came in entirely out of the blue. It was a phone call one day, never heard of the place. And so they approached me. I went for 2 interviews. The plane wasn't working the first time. I had to go back the next week to give a talk to the staff and so on. It was called Mathematica, located in Bethesda, Maryland. I wasn't sure where Bethesda was, and I never heard of Mathematica. So this was a kind of first career turning point. I'll use the word turning point a lot during this talk. And it sprung from a minor professional crisis. Nobody was firing me, but the institute was getting uncomfortable. So I guess you can say that Washington was calling to assess my interest in a government consulting job about which I knew nothing. The name of the company, it was Mathematica. Our subsidiary was called Math Tech. And I said, it's Bethesda's very close to DC. And we live in Potomac, very close to Bethesda, still live in the same house. This particular job opened my eyes to the world of intrigue around international diplomacy, a whole new world for me. I had to get security clearances and stuff like that. I participated in some of my most exciting projects during the 8 years. So I stayed at the Institute of Chicago for 9 years, 8 years at Mathematica. But, you know, like all consulting and soft money institutes, things whittle down after a while. You expect them, you just don't know when they're going to happen. So I moved on to another consulting firm in the same town, in Bethesda, where I directed another really interesting project on political stability for 3 years. There was political stability in the Philippines during the Marcos years. And it was a very modeling kind of project. So the next turning point occurred with what I call a serendipitous offer from a nonprofit called the National Research Council, where I actually directed study groups for a whooping 12 years. So we have 9 years, 8 years, and now 12 years. So I did stay at these places. And they included both micro-level projects. I studied enhancing human performance, very much of a psychological level of analysis, and macro-level processes. I studied with a large group issues about preventing nuclear war during the end of the Cold War, actually. During these years, I also spent time, luckily for me, in Vienna, Austria, at the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis, called IASA. I think
IASA.
No, IASA. Okay, so I was there. That was great. Had great projects. Worked with Bert Spector, Bill Zartman, and people like that. The next turning point occurred a little bit later in 1997, when the George Mason Institute for Conflict Analysis and Resolution offered me a full-time faculty job. I was never on a faculty in my entire life. I was already, how old was I? I was about 58 years old by this time. but I thought that this would be a cushy job given the ups and downs, peaks and valleys of consulting. It was anything but. Due to the curse of academic politics, which took a much larger toll on my soul than anything I experienced in the private and nonprofit sectors. I couldn't believe what was happening. A particular, I'm giving you the, you know, giving you the upsides and the downsides, so you get a really sense of what it's like to do what people like me did. A particularly severe crisis, and this is a bad one, occurred in about 2004, which pushed me to seek yet other experiences. So In between, I had gigs, short-term jobs in Turkey, Istanbul, Copenhagen, Taiwan, and Australia, and they provided adventures well beyond the confines of DC, interesting as DC can be. In Australia, I had appointments at several universities, now going into the 21st year, so we still go back. This was another crisis turning point. It's like crisis turning point moment, laden with uncertainties over the long term. How long would they keep me there? And other academic conflicts related to being an American in the Australian academic system. Probably worse than being an American in Paris, as the song goes. So I retired from GMU in 2016, 2017, but retained the Australian appointments those years. And those years were some of my most productive ones. Back to you.
Well, that's an amazing career, but at some point you started focusing on something that made you really famous and really famous in the field, so that today you belong to the small group of wise people in conflict management and negotiation. Yes? So when was what was the turning point that sort of shifted your attention in that direction then?
Good. Yeah. Well, interestingly enough, the interest began with a dissertation that I completed in 1966. So what was I, 26, 25 years old, something like that. My interest at the time was actually less about negotiation than it was about the emotional ties and constraints of being a group representative. I was really interested in representation, and negotiation was a platform to study representation. What I did in that study, and for several studies following that, I constructed a collective bargaining simulation to study those particular constraints and came out with surprising results about the relative importance of the person going in, the role, the assignment, and the situation surrounding the negotiation. It was my first publication. It appeared in a 1967 issue of the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, along with a dissertation award, which is actually right behind me. This thing here is an award from the American Institutes of Research for the best dissertation of the year or something of that sort. And that was
one of very many awards that you've received.
Well, that's a special one. That was the first, you know, that encouraged me to go on and be excited about my profession. Gee, if they like my work that much and it gets published in this journal, maybe I have something here and maybe I don't have to be an academic for a while. So that's what happened there. So that happened. So I was intrigued by the findings and I continued researching along these lines with the simulation of collective bargaining. And did a study on pre-negotiation experience, which was one of the variables in the dissertation. And that appears in a 1968 issue of the Journal of Experimental Social Psychology, another very high-ranked journal, which is also the first article in the book and one of my favorites, even though it's way outdated, still one of my favorites. This is a pretty good start for a career, although my institute colleagues at Chicago Institute, where I was, were curious about how I got away with doing this research at a place called the Institute for Juvenile Research. I stayed for 9 years, so there's a lot of subterfuge. Well, I did quite a number of bargaining studies, and actually I did many with children as research subjects, so I kind of satisfied them in some ways during my 9 years at the Institute in Chicago. I wrote a very important article, to me it was an important article, and it's fairly well cited, on boundary conflicts, boundary role conflicts. It was published in a 1977 issue of the Journal Conflict Resolution, and it appears in the book as the second article, and that was also developed during my Chicago years. It's a bit of a modeling mathematical article about the Walton and McKersey concept of satisfying your constituents while also satisfying the other side, yeah, and how you balance that. With these years behind me, I was eager to move into the real world on policy and diplomacy, and the opportunity came my way. I've already noted my move in to the DC consulting world opened my eyes to the complexities of international negotiation and the way they impacted government policy. Keep in mind, I had been doing board game experiments, some gaming experiments, simulation of collective bargaining, didn't pay a lot of attention, except that Harold Getzko, one of my professors at Northwestern, asked me to write a monograph, which was paid for, which was published as a monograph in 1973 on social psychological factors in international negotiations. So I had an academic's understanding, but not sort of a real world experiential understanding. And this is what I was going to get. More importantly, I realized, and this was important, that much of the research literature, including the research that my colleagues and I were doing, was relevant to the real world analyses that I was being contracted to perform. And I discussed this kind of relevance of research to practice in a number of publications, in a 1997 chapter for the United States Institute of Peace, in 1986 and 1990 chapters in books published by the U.S. Foreign Service Institute, and so on. Much of this work actually does come together much more recently in an article with Lynn Wagner in a 2021 issue of the Negotiation Journal, where it kind of comes together.
Yes, Dan. So basically, I remember, you know, when I look back on my career, I always try to combine academia with business, with practice. And it seems to be the case also also for you. And to me, it's been a source of inspiration, very often, which flew in both directions, not only from academia towards praxis, but also towards business, but also from business or from practice to academia. How was it for you? Did it? Which part inspired the other? And was it the academia that inspired, let's say, your work in the field, or was it the other way around?
It was both ways. So maybe the best way for me to address this question is to give three examples from my early experiences in the consulting world. So this would have been roughly 1975 to about 1984, 85. So roughly 10, 11 years, something like that. So I'll give you three examples. There were many, many others. In my very first consulting assignment, Green, you know, from Chicago, 1975, we found a house, still live in that house. and you know, we settled in. We had two very young children. I think they were, what, 3 and 7, something like that. You had to adapt to much more expensive living in Washington. But I needed a higher salary, and I got a higher salary, but the salary, you wouldn't believe what the salaries were compared to so inflation. But yeah, so we adapted, we figured it out. So the first consulting assignment was in 1975. We were asked to provide analytical tools to help U.S. negotiators to resolve conflicts over military bases in Spain. Keep in mind, this is the Cold War. The U.S. had 4 military bases in Spain. They were very important to Spain, to NATO, to the U.S. Keep in mind, it's a Cold War mentality we're dealing with. We discovered critical, and here's where the word comes up again, turning points, we call them TPs, that occurred at various junctures during the 11 rounds. And the analyses were done on transcripts of the actual negotiations at the same time. We had the transcripts while they were negotiating, so that was terrific. So based on these analyses, we showed the delegates how to anticipate a turning point, and then what to do about it. A result was an agreement, thankfully, to renew the bases, along with grants and aid to various forms of welfare, to a changing and struggling Spanish political system. I also followed the treaty ratification processes in Capitol Hill, and that's a whole other story about how I got involved with the delegates, Bob McCloskey, the head of delegation, some of the senators, and I was a consultant, I was a young consultant, and they were very, you know, forthcoming, and they were happy to have me talk to them. Okay, that was done. A second assignment was more ambitious, and it got more ambitious as it went along. We were asked, we said, oh, you did a good job on that one, same sponsor. So they said, okay, now we want you to deal with something much more complex. And that is the long stalemated talks between NATO and the Warsaw Pact. I don't know how many of you remember the Warsaw Pact. They were there.
Remy, I do.
You were a kid. You remember.
I was born on the wrong side of the wall.
Yeah, yeah. Your country was part of the Warsaw Pact. Anyway, the negotiations were about conventional troop reductions in Central Europe, a topic, again, I knew nothing about. Our analysis shed light on a particular kind of agreement involving trades between heavy, that's ICBMs, for example, and light cruise missiles, for example, weapon systems. We also learned about alliance dynamics, particularly with regard to cooperation between the two superpowers and how they interacted with their less powerful allies in both alliances. However, having done all of that work and not realizing this, it came as a big surprise, we found out that neither alliance really wanted to get an agreement after all. And we had been struggling to come up, Terry Hopman was my colleague then, and we were struggling to come up with a trade-off, you know, between the light and heavy systems that would make, so we thought we had the example, and the ambassador, Jock Dean, agreed that that was a good one, but nobody wanted to get an agreement. They benefited more by keeping the talks going to prevent reductions, even though they were talking about reductions. And then they were both in collusion against their respective legislatures. Very interesting phenomenon. Fred Ickley calls that negotiating for side effects. A really powerful example.
Instrumentally, right? So this
They kept it up for 13, 14 years, I think, before it got converted into something else. The third assignment was probably the most interesting one. The Soviets walked out of the strategic arms race, the START talks.
START, yeah.
In 1983. The U.S. Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, the acronym is ACDA, asked us on a consulting agreement to help them figure out ways to get the Soviet delegation back to the table. And they gave me an office in the State Department for the summer, a summer office. Our offices were in Bethesda, Maryland. We went downtown. And they didn't give me parking privileges, so I had to feed the meter about every hour, back and forth, back and forth. But I had a nice office, and I had access to the classified transcripts at the time. And I did sort of rose to the challenge and developed a content analysis system. And we, you know, applied the categories and sort of analyzed them throughout the period leading up to the walkout by the Soviets. Most notably, we found in our analyses, and I don't know if this is surprising, but it did come through that the Soviets felt disrespected by the U.S. delegation. They wanted to be regarded as equals to the U.S. Parity and status seemed to be their main concern, more so than specifics, details on reducing weapon systems. Knowing this, the agency, ACTA, engaged in discussions of the best strategy to satisfy these concerns without making unilateral concessions. Although it took a year to reconvene the talks, and they did reconvene them, they did come back, and of course, we took all the credit. So,
well done.
Well, yeah. So each of these consulting assignments provided themes which were developed further in the research literature, crises and turning points, negotiating for side effects, intra-alliance power, and parity. Over to you.
So that's how these areas so cross-pollinated each other. So in your case, it was more from your consulting work towards research, right? But it's also the other way around as well, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yep.
Great. Any behind the scenes anecdotes from those times? Any from the Cold War times? From your consulting jobs in DC, Department of State? Anything that the readers would be interested to find out about?
Okay. Yeah, I devote a chapter in the book to behind the scenes, I give a number of examples. Things that are invisible, really, to readers of articles. You think somehow it's a smooth process, and you do the research, and you hunker down, and you work hard, you go through peer reviews, you revise, rewrite. You think that's the whole thing. Got news for you. That is not the whole thing.
It's not.
Research contributions that are visible to readers and audience when you make presentations are made possible by the institutions that employ us and the sponsors that provide the support. Can't do it without them. Research institutes need budgets. Consulting firms need clients. universities need grants, all with enough overhead to house us. So it's a big deal. I learned the hard lessons early in my career that the researcher, consultant, or faculty member plays the essential role in attracting these resources. I thought I would always have people who were specialists as administrators to kind of help you get grants. Well, sometimes they were hired, but if you didn't, you know, if you weren't proactive, you didn't take the initiative, nothing much would happen. And yeah. I learned that in several places where I worked. So we must sell our projects internally, internally, especially at the National Research Council, and externally to the sponsors, potential sponsors. My early years at the Chicago Institute were covered by the state of Illinois generously and the National Institutes of Health generously, and they both provided general support for a variety of projects, some of which I've already talked about. So these were the days, and I was spoiled. But two of my professors, their names were Harold Getzko and Tom Milburn, brought me into the projects that turned out to prepare me for the new, for the kind of a next stage, a new career in international relations and policy, from social psychology all the way to that. These sponsors were the Academy for Educational Development and the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, about which I've already spoken. Little did I know at the time that these projects prepared me for the next turn in my career. The consulting years were made possible by government clients, a variety of government clients, task forces, state departments, defense departments, all that stuff. There was a task force for the MBFR, conventional reduction talks in the Pentagon, active for the START consulting, and both the Army Research Institute and the Carnegie Corporation of New York for the National Research Council projects. The NRC projects initially only put their feet in the water by supporting short projects and gravitated to a full body plunge by keeping us going for over a decade at the NRC. In other words, what we did, without even realizing it at the time, we were converting sponsors into benefactors. Yes, by doing good work, but also by looking forward to the work that still needed to be done. We had to always make the case that we were indispensable to accomplishing their missions. Another book could easily be written about the strategies for pulling this sort of thing off. Another point worth making is that I was well aware of the need to keep publishing, even when not encouraged to do so by the consulting firms I worked for or even the National Research Council. They didn't care if I published or I didn't.
Right.
So I did this by sacrificing many evenings and weekends in my other career with the hope that a cushy academic position was waiting somewhere beyond the sea, as the song goes. Turned out not to be. However, as I hinted at earlier, all was not roses. There were some bitter experiences in this career journey, which I'll share with you. It's the downside. Things blew up badly with the hiring of a new director at the George Mason Institute. Remember, I had gone from the NRC 12 years to George Mason, where I stayed for, I don't know, must have been close to 20 years. Without sharing the gory details, and they were gory, This particular person was on a crusade to end rather than support careers that were not within the scope of her postmodern ideology and interests, bearing grudges and persuading the provost of the university to support her crusades. Well, this was another crisis that cried out for a new life. I ran off with my wife and kids. Oh no, kids were already in college. Kids weren't a part of this. To Australia, and I changed departments from the Conflict Institute to Political Science at GMU. Yet, it sounds great, right? And it was great in many ways, but all was not rosy there either. It was difficult for me to adapt to the top-down structure used to regulate courses, to the grading policies, and to teaching how to do experiments and statistical research in Australia at the University of Queensland. The coup de grace was the moment when the head of the school presented me with an ultimatum. I needed to support my salary with grants matched by the school with teaching. That they'll do half and I have to get the other half. So I did rise to the challenge, only to be faced with a 60% overhead. They took 60% the value of my grants for the university.
Nice.
Unbelievable. I've never heard of that before. I thought they were discriminating against me, but I found that they weren't. This is what they did at the University of Queensland, if not at all Australian universities.
I've heard 20%, for about 20, 30% to be standard, but 60 is a lot.
60%. So a little anecdote. So one day I went to the library. I was very angry at the time. I went to the library. I asked the librarian, can you please get this book for me? And she was taking a long time, 10, 15 minutes ago. I said, excuse me. Could you speed it up a little bit? She said, well, I'm trying my best. I said, I'm paying your salary. In other words, that 60% went to all sorts of infrastructure projects in the university. Right. And they pushed their faculty hard to get these grants, which were hardly enough to complete our research projects. Anyway, well, you know the story by now. I beat it out of there. And thanks to a very sympathetic colleague, found two other universities that gave me a pass on the overhead. No overhead, from 60 to nothing. I just had to be sure that I kept on publishing and put their name down as my affiliation on publications. So once again, we turned short-term sponsors into kind of like benefactors with about a decade of support in Australia. When I went to the new university, the support came from Swedish agencies for the work that I did on justice with my Uppsala colleague, Cecilia Albin. There are many other behind-the-scenes stories, but not enough time to talk about them. These include, quickly, dealing with a very troubled major graduate school professor and several collaborators in my life, maybe you have the same experience, Remy, who simply dropped out of ongoing projects and stopped communicating. I was left holding the bag. Suffice it to say that resilience is necessary to sail the rough waters of social science careers, both inside and outside of academia.
Well, that's an amazing career with lots of turning points. And if I may, can I throw a question about the turning points right here? Because for many of us in the field, you are very closely affiliated with the concept of turning points, which you researched extensively at some point in your career. It would be very important that our listeners and viewers hear about what turning points are, how they can recognize them and take advantage of the moment when they recognize them.
Sure. Okay, yeah, I can talk about that, certainly. And so I discovered the concept. It wasn't original. Charlie McClelland, an IR professor at University of Southern California, came up with a concept in a chapter that he wrote on the Taiwan Straits conflict. It was written in 1972. I kind of took the concept, made it relevant to these real world negotiations that I talked about, that I had been studying. So eventually, and I published a lot of papers. The very first one was on the space rights case, 1986 in the JCR. It's probably my favorite article in many ways. So it gravitated to a kind of framework. I felt I needed a framework that would be generalizable enough so others could also study turning points in a variety of settings. And that, so that framework dealt with three parts: precipitance, departures, and consequences. That has been elaborated into four or five parts later on. But in any event, it was a cause effect, fairly linear, somewhat positivist kind of conception of, if you can understand the causes, you can understand the effects, if you can understand the long-term effects, then you're dealing with a process concept of turning points. So the turning points might be the departures, but I came to think of it as these three parts. And we did develop coding rules for identifying each of the parts, and we did a lot of reliability testing to be sure that people agreed when they saw a precipitant or a cause, they knew that it was going to lead to something like a departure. And often in my early studies, the precipitants were crises. They were difficult moments in the negotiation. They caused an impasse, and the two teams would separate and go home. So Spain, Madrid, U.S. goes back to Washington, one East Spanish goes back to Madrid. Same with the Soviets in Moscow and Washington, and so on and so on. And it looks like all hope is lost. And then you have to be a little bit creative and come up with a new framing of the negotiation. And that's what I call the departure. Get back to the table and see how that develops. If it stays, the way you want it, it could lead to an agreement. If it sours, it could lead to a negative turning point, which is also possible. Right. So it could be agreement, it could be further impasses, it could be disillusion, as in fact was the case with the Soviet walkout in the START talks that I studied. And then we went haywire with the turning points idea and started using it in a variety of different settings. The most recent was something about automobile talks that I studied with a colleague, and so on. But it took off, and other people used the concept, usually quite interestingly and correctly. Will Hall, one of my students, developed a much more elaborate conception of an environmental negotiation, multilateral environmental negotiations. He wrote a book on it. It had a lot of, it took off. It was one of those ideas that I'm proud of, but, you know, it led to many other things. And so there you go.
Yes, thank you so much for a detailed explanation. I was wondering, you know, in terms of one more question on turning points, and then we move on to flexibility, which was also a large chunk of your work described in the book. Is it better to allow for a departure in the negotiation so that we can come back to the table knowing that there is a risk of a no deal, a tangible risk of a no deal? Or is it better to prevent it when we sense that the turning point is coming up?
It's a great question. I've actually written a little bit on that. I actually think the former. I think crises are can be, not always, invaluable. For as a kind of, let's say, a wake-up call. Suddenly, both parties or all parties realize, hey, we're in trouble. Got to do something about it. So let's take a time out. Let's take a break. Let's get away from this formal negotiations. Let's go back. Let's retrench and let's get to better informally. Let's do a conflict resolution workshop. That doesn't happen too often. But let's get the emotions behind it all. That's tricky, and that could lead to more problems. But yes, I think recognizing trouble when it happens is the primary but not the only precipitating factor for the departure that's needed to get things back on track. So I would advocate for recognizing, articulating, and then doing something about it.
All right. That sounds great. Sounds like a good prescriptive advice. All right. Let's move on to the next chapter in your book, which you devoted to flexibility. How did your interest in that field start? When did you discover flexibility? How you defined it, and what consequences does your work have for our listeners and viewers?
I talk about it, and at some point I want to come back to levels of analysis, but let's do that after I talk about flexibility.
Yeah.
Okay, it's a great question and one I'm certainly interested in. It came before turning points. So it's an absorbing interest, as you point out, and it stemmed in part from my childhood experience. I grew up in New York City, and there's a lot of bad things going on where I grew up in New York City. I'll get to that. But it was more due to exposure to Milton Rokic's work on dogmatism, who was one of my teachers as an undergraduate. So I grew up in a New York City environment, I don't want to let that go yet, where people held on to their prejudicial beliefs, despite how liberal New York is. And it's also a source of significant conflict in the workplace and in social life more generally. So my personal experience before I became a professional anything was to combat prejudice, like most of we progressives always try to do. And Gordon Allport's book, The Nature of Prejudice, was very influential as an undergraduate. And I said, yeah, this is where I want to go. This is where I want to be. And then I became a social psychologist. So Rokic's work, I hope many of you heard of Milton Rokic, was a significant departure from the Berkeley tradition of the authoritarian personality. Very famous book in the 1950s, written by Adorno and his colleagues. He separated the content of beliefs, that is right or left, you know, liberal or conservative, whatever, from the structure of belief systems. So he did a very good job on structures. However, I became more interested in flexible behavior, not so much inside belief systems, and the situations that encouraged or discouraged it. So let me give you some highlights of what this research was about. So I distinguished between flexible bargaining behavior and problem solving, which is a big distinction made by most of us in the conflict management field. I did a stream of experiments on factors that encouraged or discouraged making concessions. This is very early research in the 70s, such as the concession rate used by the bargaining opponent, or the size of the first offer, and other things. Another line of work concentrated on how people cooperate to solve bargaining problems. My interest is in achieving integrative agreements where all parties are satisfied. Most recently, we found that a robot, of all things, a robot mediator, encourages the students to find flexible, creative solutions to very difficult conflicts. The bargainer's flexibility in those experiments was largely due to a social bonding effect, which we discovered when we did process analysis, by the common unusual experience they had with the robot, with this kind of media. They laughed about it, but then they realized that maybe this robot was stimulating them to think more creatively, and in fact they did. So there's a very good article with seven of us as authors in Group Decision and Negotiation, which lays that line of research out. My most ambitious work, however, on flexibility was something that I call situational levers, and there is a chapter in the book on that idea. Here I investigated the relative impacts on flexibility of a variety of aspects of multilateral negotiations on environmental regulations. That work was done at IASA in Vienna.
Vienna.
Yeah. And, you know, things like, did the negotiators represent governments or not? What was the location, central or peripheral, of the conference? The extent to which there's media coverage, whether they were negotiating against the deadline, and a bunch of other things, a lot of situational levers. We had to develop a different methodology for analyzing the data. Interestingly, I won't belabor this point, representing a group or a nation mattered most in the early stages, while media attention mattered most during the later stages of that same simulated negotiation. There were also differences between diplomats from the Vienna Academy of Diplomacy and graduate scientists at IASA, at the Research Institute. There were also differences between them. The former, the diplomats, were more responsive to the comprehensiveness of the agreement sought, while the latter were more concerned with power differences. Other way around, the former being the scientist wanted a comprehensive agreement. The diplomats were concerned with how to resolve power differences among the eight representatives. We also compared the simulation findings with case studies, that's reported in the article, finding both similarities and dissimilarities, and also with a meta-analysis of 80 experiments dealing with bargaining flexibility. And chapter 9 in the book gets into some of these findings. So that's pretty much of where the flexibility came from and what I did about it.
Thank you, Dan. Isn't it a paradox that your interest in dogmatism led to your research on flexibility?
Yeah. Although I think Milton Roque had the same interest, though he didn't use the same terminology. I think he studied dogmatism to learn how to combat it.
Most
dogmatic. he rebelled against things like religion and religious dogma. And so he had in his personal life.
All right. And in newer literature, there is a concept of strategic flexibility, which is kind of similar, not exactly the same. It might be a little bit wider. But the question is like, can we learn, or can we teach and learn and or learn to be more flexible or more strategically adaptable in negotiation? Is it something that we can, in one way or another, influence through training?
Yeah, certainly can. So my experience in teaching, which I do also have done, negotiating skills, is based on an assumption that people can learn to be more flexible and more adaptive. That assumption is supported by empirical research. Most notably, a large body of research on plasticity, which includes cognitive plasticity and neuroplasticity. Actually, I'm not an expert on those topics, but I do follow the literature. And the best of it was done by a colleague who sadly passed away during COVID. His name was Anders Ericsson from Florida State University, a cognitive psychologist. And he wrote a terrific popular book called Peak. I encourage everybody to have a look at this very well-written book about plasticity and change. The challenge is to provide the vehicles for increasing flexibility. So my research on pre-negotiation experience, on the interplay between values and interests, on other affirmation with Fika Harink, on building trust, and on the situational levers provides evidence supporting interventions that do enhance flexibility. There are examples, there are examples of this research incorporated in our training exercises, about which I don't speak a lot in the book. And they're also accompanied by evaluations, which showed that trainees, usually civil servants, UN people, and also graduates, claim that they benefited over the short term and long term from learning how research informs them about how to behave.
So yes, there is hope. There is hope for us. We can all learn to be more strategically adaptable and or flexible in negotiation. We just need to have such great professors like yourself then.
Yeah. Not sure about the latter, but yes, we need to learn.
All right. The next part of the book is devoted to social justice. It's a big part. I think you've mentioned already your that phase in your career when you worked with Cecilia Albin and others. What's so exciting about social justice?
Yeah. Is it not exciting?
It's totally exciting. But how did you get to the topic? Well, first of all, maybe what it is. What are norms of social justice? And yeah. What inspired your research in this area? And what can we learn from it for our negotiations?
Yeah. Sure. So, my early experience, my interest in prejudice and all that stuff. So I became a very progressive. Go, Kamala. Anyway, so this all happened. It was actually a chance meeting at a conference I attended in Kent, England, of all places. It led, so I met Cecilia, who was a former student of mine, actually. And it led to a very long collaboration on social justice. So that's the background. We actually began with a very modest grant from the Norwegian Ministry of Foreign Relations to study distributive justice in 16 cases of civil war agreements. It's a nice small grant, and it satisfied the University of Queensland, even though they took 60% of it. So we found that the principle of equality, not equity so much, but equality more, when adhered to in the agreements that are negotiated, facilitated the implementation of the agreements, as you might expect, but as shown by the empirical research. We also learned, probably more importantly, that procedural justice principles, I know, Remy, you have an interest in that, during the negotiation process strengthened implementation. We were encouraged to extend our studies then to other contexts, and we got additional funding, which again satisfied the Australian universities. We had a three-year grant from, I think it was a Swedish bank foundation who wanted to be philanthropic, just as the Carlsbad Beer Foundation in Denmark funded our robot work because they wanted to look like they were philanthropic as well. this foundation provided 3 years of funding, and we studied, we got away from the peace agreement, we studied trade negotiations, arms control negotiations, environmental negotiations, three separate publications or studies that were done with Cecilia and myself. And we were a good division of labor. Cecilia much more into qualitative case study research, me in the statistical part. So suffice it to say for now, that context did make a rather large difference. The relative emphasis on distributive or procedural justice did vary by settings. Again, distributive is kind of fairness in the outcome. Procedural is kind of fairness in the process. So it's like outcome justice and process justice. Well, we kept this line going with yet more grants, this time from the Swedish Research Council. We actually got two grants from them. And we expanded our focus from implementing peace agreements to durable societal peace. So this will get us closer to this levels of analysis thing, which I maybe I'll talk about next. The big finding there was that we discovered a path across 50 cases, went from 16 to 50 cases, very large project. Procedural justice during the negotiation process produced fair agreements, which in turn strengthened implementation and increased the chances for durable peace over an 8-year period following the peace agreement. A key here, and this is very important, that PJ, or procedural justice, initiated the starting mechanism, initiated the process, and thus may be regarded, according to our research, as a key to peace. You know, if you can teach or learn or consult with negotiators, if that were possible, you teach them how to articulate the ideas of procedural justice and how to abide by transparency and fair conduct and stuff like that. But we did not stop this line of research with these studies. We continued to investigate roles played by civil society in the peace process and how rebel groups in civil wars influence sustained peace. Those were add-on studies. With regard to the former, we discovered the important role played by something called inclusive commissions, work I do with Ezra Kuhadar from Ankara, Turkey. And we have a publication in the International Studies Perspective recently. On the latter, the rebels research, the key was whether rebel groups converted into political parties. If they did, peace was maintained over a long period. If they didn't, just the opposite. So conversion was important. That article appears more recently, a special issue that some of us edited in the International Journal of Conflict Management with my colleagues, Sinisa Vukovic as well.
Vukovic.
Yeah. So that gives you an idea of, I had been a justice guy all my life. It is later in my life that I discovered it was a research topic and a researchable topic. And took off with it and seemed to satisfy both my personal political politics and also my professional identification as a researcher.
That was an amazing, piece of work that you guys did together with Cecilia on while studying 50 peace agreements. And it inspired us to also to have a closer look at the Colombian peace process. Together with Margarita and Peter Kesting, Margarita Canales.
That's a terrific article. It appears in the very same special issue as our rebel study does. The interesting thing about the three studies I talked about, they're all based on using that 50 case data sets. And we code it for different things. You know?
Yes, exactly.
That's a terrific article that you guys did. Yeah.
Thank you so much. So let's talk about connecting the levels of analysis. I think by now we know that your interests in negotiation and conflict resolution cannot be confined into one only specific area, right? Yes. You looked at various aspects. And can you tell us a little bit more about what drove you in that direction? Yes.
Thank you very much for asking. Maybe that's really the central theme. Maybe it's not so much flexibility and turning points. Maybe it is this levels of analysis idea. It's developed in chapter, the best development of it is in a theoretical chapter 16 in the book, if you want to read it, with Steve Wood. My interest can be traced back to the earliest years of graduate school. I was in programs that valued interdisciplinary analyses. I thought of myself first as a social scientist rather than as a psychologist, sociologist, or a political scientist. When I studied social psychology, it was about behavior in context. Simulations do that. Sociology was about groups and the Durkheimian concept of a distinct social level of analysis. I bought on to that, I've changed since. Political science introduced me to the importance of international institutions. Now, so my challenge, just want to get my notes straight, my challenge was to find a nexus or a connection among these levels. And I think it's been kind of a lifelong quest in some ways. All my studies are imbued with this question. Individuals, small groups, collectivities, and systems.
And systems.
Yeah. So I wondered about the impacts of negotiating processes and outcomes on the larger society being represented, namely durable peace. I also wondered about how group identities aggregate to become collective identities. That's tricky. And I asked about how collective opinions emerge from opinions expressed by individuals in opinion polls. There's a body of research that argues for distinct levels of analysis in the Emil Durkheim tradition, bolstering the case for separate disciplines, say psychology, sociology, political science, economics, and so on. But there's also writing that makes the opposite case of integrating the levels, the poorest levels, promoting the integrative arguments, as I do in chapter 16, which I just mentioned, leads to these, what I call porous boundaries among levels, such that the influence travels upward, downward, and sideways. And that's kind of the title of the chapter as well. One more point on this. Examples of how the levels interact came from attempts to negotiate the peace agreements that I've been talking about, from the role of different types of civil society groups in the political process, from identity issues in national politics, from interactive conflict resolution, John Burton, Herb Kelman, Chris Mitchell, the workshops that they do, and from how members of the European Union balance national with supranational identities. We have a section in that chapter on that. A particularly interesting example of the way that community activities involving former combatants following the peace agreement bridge the negotiated agreements with a more durable peace at the high level of analysis. In other words, from all the parts of durable, and there are 16 parts of durable peace, a very complex multidimensional measurement, the one that comes out the strongest is their willingness to engage in cooperative communal activities, rebel groups and government representatives. And when they do that, that kind of provides the adhesion, that kind of enables them to go further and to actually think about and do institutional change, which is also part of durable peace.
This reminds me very much of the physical on the search for singularity or unifying theory in physics, right?
Yeah.
Because we somewhat know that there are different laws governing the behavior of elements on depending on the scale. Yes.
Yeah.
And the question is there an overarching theory that can help us understand conflict and its resolution, which somehow unifies the scales, these scales, right? So from nations to groups to individuals, right? Or do we say, well, maybe nations behave like agents, right? Or maybe we could convert nations to agents and then assume that they would behave like individuals, which we're basically very frequently do in game theory, right? We somehow reduce the collective agents into an agent, right? Singular agents. But the question is it correct? Yes. Is it correct? Do we not lose sort of generality by doing so? Right. So what do you think then? Will we ever find a singular unifying theory of conflict management?
So the guy who did the most impressive work on this was, his name was Miller. I don't know if it was George Miller, but Miller, he was the president of Cleveland State University at the time. He was also the editor of a journal called Behavioral Science. And he devoted two or more issues of that journal. Can't remember what the year would have been, probably in the late 60s, early 70s. To just doing that. He was both a medical doctor and a PhD. He had the biology and he had the social science, so on. He was probably the perfect guy to do it. It was impressive. It was very impressive. And his journey was an upward journey. He went from cells to societies to international systems. He actually moved in that direction. He didn't move back in the other direction. But he had such command of this voluminous interdisciplinary literature that it was impressive. And it didn't leave me cold. It left me excited about the concept of levels. I'm not a fan, on the other hand, of singularity. That is, I'm not a fan of the theory, the anything for that matter, the charismatic leader. I'm really, that really is bothering given the current state of politics here. In any event, it's been tried. People want to have the theory of theories and so on.
Right.
I don't think that's quite right. And the idea of integrating the levels that is moving in these different directions provides a more fluid, if you want to say flexible, you can as well, a more fluid understanding of social life, which is really what I think most of us are interested in. The commonalities are important because the commonalities is what provide the frameworks, like the turning points framework, for others to study other cases and contexts using a similar or the same theoretical understanding. So the idea of a framework that can be changed, that's dynamic as well. A framework is important to guide research and to communicate among us when we're looking at different cases but studying the same concepts.
Right.
So that's a complex and a long-winded answer to your question. No, not a single, but on the other hand, there is the idea of framework as a governing thing. And let me say one more thing, since I do follow some of the neural plasticity of an interest, flexibility. What they're finding now, interestingly enough, is that DNA is not fixed, that it is also fluid and dynamic, and it's changing with experience, almost Lamarckian in conception, almost not quite. And that's very exciting because that has implications for the kind of social behavior that we study and the kind of advocacy of learning and adaptability that, in fact, yeah, DNA is a fingerprint. You can catch criminals and thieves and stuff with it, just like your fingers are. But DNA is unlikely to be an important element or a cause of a social behavior.
Right. Yeah, this is one of many. Yep.
Yeah.
One of many. Yeah. All right. Since we're approaching 1 hour mark of our chat, let's reduce the remaining questions to the most important for those who are watching us. In terms of recommendations and advice for young scholars who are looking up to you and thinking, oh, well, this guy is so wise, he's published so widely, and he's so established and distinguished. What can I do to be like him?
Don't do it. Do something else. Actually, that was not true of my children. They became professors too. They're not like me. They're their own. They have their own careers. Anyway, let me approach this correctly. Rather than to think about research and practice as different career pursuits, okay? So I consider them as part and parcel, saying, as do you, Remy, by which I mean embed research and practice and embed practice and research, so on. So several examples illustrate that point. First, there were the negotiation skills workshops that I engaged in, supported by the United States Institute of Peace, which I did for quite some years. In that project, we developed 16 research narratives covering such themes as emotions, culture, power, alternatives, time pressure, integrative agreements, and on and on and on. Workshop participants read the narratives, answered questions about them, applied the learning in exercises that placed them in the roles of analyst, strategist, designer, and negotiator. Most participants walked away from the experience with an appreciation of the research. So the idea, and I mentioned it earlier, the idea, if you're building this kind of practice, research, application, basic research kind of career, it's important to try. And there aren't many people like us, you know, there are others like me, but not as intently interested in trying to make sure that research is the basis for making recommendations about practice. And research has limits. We can only go so far. And I have plugged that in recent articles, including one we just got peer reviews today from a journal about an article where we develop an online conflict coach. It's only valuable because it takes research findings and it converts them into advice. And I just wrote a paper for an anniversary issue of International Negotiation. In that paper, what Lynn Wagner and I do is we take research findings and say, how valuable is this knowledge for approaching the possibility of negotiations in the Gaza conflict? How valuable is this for trying to think through the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So don't have the answers. We just say that things like fractionating the conflict, there are ideas from the research literature that can make a difference. Second, well, I already talked about this. So the Gaza, yeah. So there are ideas about delinking ideologies from interests, about fractionating conflicts, cooperating between moderates on both sides, if we can find them, and the advantages of biased mediation. We make a big deal about how it can be that Qatar can be a biased mediator and can be effective actually because of that, not in spite of that. So third, and maybe finally, I need to talk about this a little bit because this has just happened. I was asked to be a consultant on a project to save the Great Barrier Reef in Australia. It was a government-sponsored report with 40 reef scientists, they call them, real scientists, so to speak. They asked me, as a social scientist, some experience of doing this, to develop a consensus technique, some way of getting these scientists who have different ways of interpreting research to get on the same page and come up with a report with conclusions that would help the government take action by debleaching and climate change, by doing things to save this wonderful natural resource. So I came up with the single text procedure used by Jimmy Carter in the 1977 talks with Sadat and Begin. You might remember that historically. It's based on theoretical ideas concerning how to increase a sense of ownership in the solution by giving participants a place in the drafting process. I'm not going to go into more detail. We've not written this up yet. It worked very well. Somebody writes a draft, everybody else edits it. Nobody sees each other's edits. And in the end, they actually come up with a kind of consensus or convergent draft. So all of these examples and more illustrate the value of evidence-based ideas. I make a big deal about that in the final chapter of the book. Evidence-based ideas in the practice of managing and resolving conflicts. We've also discussed the value of conflict management, interesting, rather than resolution for intractable conflicts, including the idea of gradual progress toward discussing the large dividing issues, very slow progress. For me, a research-based practice provides advantages not available to practitioners without research training, so we have something to offer. And that theme is developed further in a recent article I do with Bill Donahue from Michigan State on negotiation and negotiating conflict management research. So there you go.
Thank you so much, Dan. We got a question from one of our viewers right now, which I'm now displaying on our screen. Which of the conflict resolution tools you've observed could, in your opinion, be improved in modern-day international conflicts, and why?
Okay, let me try and digest the question. Which of the conflict management tools could improve modern-day conflicts, and why? One of the tools, which I don't talk about a lot, even in the book, is this idea of positive affirmation. So I did two studies published in the JCR and in GDN with Fika Harink from the Netherlands on implicit and explicit value affirmation. These are value conflicts. They're intractable conflicts, but there's an interest component to them as well. And when you do something really simple, like, for example, write down five things you like about this other person, you know, write them down. Or when we say, tell the other person five things you like about them, and they do this exercise, we actually find that you come up with significantly more joint agreements or integrative agreements. That's a simple procedure that can be used. There are, and we have the conflict coaching electronic tool that takes different research findings and embeds them in the advice we give about resolving very specific conflicts in a variety of areas. So there's that as well. Mm-hmm. And I'm still a fan of role reversing, which is a very old idea, but positive affirmation is a form of role
reversing.
Yeah.
All right. So let's finish off with the outlook. the future of negotiation studies. If there's any person that is most appropriate for answering this question, that's definitely you, Dan. You've seen so much. You're involved in on the editorial boards of several journals, so you know what's happening in the field. If you were to extrapolate it into the future a little bit, yes, and play a futurologist here in our field, where is it all going? What do you think?
Yeah. So the last chapter of the book does just that, and that's the idea of looking toward the future. And what I do in that chapter is that five topics for further scholarly work on the three themes of the book, negotiation, identity, justice. One of the ideas is has to do with the identity theme and deals with in-group or partisan bias. Questions to be addressed. Here are some examples of questions. How can incentives be developed for working together as in community projects following peace agreements? Can social contact be effective in changing derogatory social categorizations? How can we reduce the illusion of morality as self-interest? That's a really important question. And which is the more important motivation for group bias? Is it in-group liking or is it out-group disliking, referred to as positive or negative partisanship? And we have a study submitted on that issue. With regard to values and interests, another fairly large part of my own career, we have lots to learn about how to reduce the extent to which value or ideological differences pose threats to identity. What is more effective? Working around the values, in other words, more or less ignoring them, or emphasizing shared interests while retaining a commitment to central values, which is better? Justice is a fertile area. We've already talked about that. Some of the topics include clarifying the causal change involving trust, identities, and justice. We don't have a good sense of the causality. Roles played by compensatory justice to offset power asymmetry. Didn't talk much about that. And compensate payments, for example, and the importance of addressing issues of forgiveness before tackling the larger issues of creating a more just society, central to conflict resolution workshops. On boundary roles, a lot to learn about how constituents communicate with their representatives, about the impacts of divided constituencies on attempts to reach agreement. Hilly Aldering does excellent work on that. About the relational consequences of arguments and the roles played by different segments of civil society, given our most recent work, and rebel conversion in sustaining agreements and contributing to durable peace. Larger questions come into play with regard to levels of analysis, which I talked about, and that's chapter 16. We ask about micro-level processes in negotiation, how do they influence post-agreement community building, at the meso level, and this idea of going up and down these ladders of societal processes, including institutional norms and rules. Along these lines are findings showing the importance of communal cooperation, which I've talked about several times, so I'm pretty hot on that idea, in providing a bridge between peace agreements and societal peace is relevant. We'd like to learn more about the mechanisms and much more generally, how can we translate these sorts of abstract questions, they often are abstract questions, into hypotheses suitable for empirical research? And if you want to transition to your very last question about looking back on the career, I'd be happy to just conclude with those.
Let's do that.
Okay. So it's very short, and I have just four or five takeaways, which I've talked about. So I'm just summarizing. So one, research and applied careers are not either or choices, as Remy's career, my career, many other careers illustrate, we can do both. Adapt to changes in the way knowledge is generated while also contributing to those changes. Adapt to the structural imperatives of institutions. You can't avoid bureaucratic requirements if you work for an institute, if you're not an entrepreneur or a freelancer. So you have to come to terms with them, but you can also contribute to those institutions or work around them by looking for opportunities, I always did, for doing the research that you care about most without being penalized or fired for that matter. Above all, and here we go back to the themes that I've talked about, be flexible, resilient, and true to the reasons that motivated you to develop this kind of career, this kind of social science kind of career. And to quote the famous martial arts guru, Bruce Lee, and you may have opinions about Bruce Lee, he says, life is wide, limitless. There's no border, no frontier. Adding to this, I suggest the value of learning to be resilient. And I had to be that throughout my life. So there you have it. So I leave the listeners out there to judge whether they think that this is a career worth writing about, which I already did, and speaking about, which I'm doing now. My hope is that they agree that somehow, some way, somewhere, it is. And thank you very much for having me, Remy.
Dan, you know, I could listen to you for hours. In fact,
okay, when let's keep on going.
In fact, when we met in Singapore on the conference, I pretty much stole all your breaks, wanting to exchange ideas, see what you think about this and the other thing. And guys, if you would like to find out what Dan Druckmann thinks about negotiation, identity, justice, figure out what paths to agreements we have or can have, and find out more about his questions in terms of the sequels to this book. Yes, if you're interested in writing the next chapter or the sequel to this book, please make sure you read this book first. Yes, I'll add the link in the comments. And Dan, thank you so much for being with us. It's been a great pleasure and honor to speak.
Yeah. So Remy, if there are any other questions, I'd be glad to take them for a few minutes.
Thank you so much, Dan. If there's anything, guys, that you would like to ask spontaneously, happy to. I don't see any other questions, so we can wrap it up for today. It's been a long session. It's been a long night for us. Dan, right. Thank you so much for everything.
Okay, I think I'll go for a swim now.
All right. Enjoy it. Take care. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.